Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 3, delivered on January 22nd.
Tonight, financial institutions. Now that we've had a nice long weekend. But first, the markets, of course, and this will become more relevant with the classes as they proceed. The terminology and what we're looking at behind the scenes here. Get off, you ignorant advertisements. Okay, now, let's try this. Madam, good day or bad day on the street?
Bad,
good. Actually, it's just kind of mixed. It's a very, you had nothing really spectacular happening. Just a couple of markets up, a couple of markets down. Nothing to really write home about. It's just a quiet day. There was no major breaking news that would affect the markets. They're in a wait-and-see attitude. As you can see, gold and silver, the metals did have a little bit of an up day. And the bond market just sort of sat there, just flat. So this is classically one of those days where there was nothing to write home about, nothing at all to get anyone excited whatsoever. So there's that. And moving on, just to look at a few securities to set up some of what I'm going to talk about tonight, look at a couple of different stocks just to have a look at what's going on. We'll look at some of the classics. We can Netflix and chill here. And as you can see, just because a market doesn't go anywhere doesn't mean stocks within a market are dead. This is an NASD stock, a NASDAQ stock, I'm sorry. It has four-letter symbol, NFLX. So that would mean that this is trading on the NASDAQ. It's an over-the-counter market, which I'll get into in more detail later on tonight. And the stock lost some ground. It took a pretty decent beating. We never really care too much about the dollar amount as we do the percentage change. From the close yesterday to the close today, we lost, Netflix lost 3.5% of the stock price. So if you're holding Netflix and that's your only stock you're holding, you lost about $12 a share, or more importantly, you lost about 3.5% of the value of your holding. Now the bid and the ask, again, the bid is what you are going to sell it at, the ask is what you're going to buy it at. And then in this case, you would see that's actually a fairly wide spread. Not really, because this is a high-priced stock. So if you wanted to buy this stock, you would buy it at $325.70. And if you wanted to sell it, you would sell it at $325.30. These are the numbers that matter, really. This number up here is just sort of like there. It's sort of like a settle price at the end of the day. But your actual activity, buying and selling, is going to be on the bid and the ask. So there's that. Now, as you can see, the day's range, it swung about, $13, a little, $12.50 maybe. It swung through that range today. So it was a kind of a boom up and down. So at the high for the day, it was up here at 336.29. By the end, the lowest point of the day looks like, what about here? I hate these mice here. 2378, and then there, 2378. I can't read. Don't get old. You go blind, and it's embarrassing. 323.78. 323. Matter of fact, it got a little below that trough price there. This is kind of grainy. It's not fine enough to see the very bottom of the trough. But over the past 52 weeks, this stock has swung from $252 up to almost $386. So right now, it's kind of like in the what, about the middle of its 52-week range? If I were to look over the 1 year, yeah, it's right about in the middle. There's the high over the last 52 weeks right there, and there's the low after over the last 52 weeks. Now, the next thing I want to show you. Now, by the way, this will you might very well have something like this on a screen, as we call these, a screen on a quiz or a test. It'll ask you some questions, nothing really profound. Just show me you know how to read these numbers. The next thing, what did I want to talk? Well, there was something I wanted to mention, and now I can't. Anyway, this. This is really hard to see because, look, the volume today, interestingly enough, look at the volume today. North of 21 million shares traded, but on an average day over the last year, only less than 6 million shares is traded. So this was an active day for this stock. It traded a lot, but you can't really see it. These are the volume bars. You notice that there was the volume bars here. You notice that there was a lot of volume right at the opening. You see those higher bars there? And then it was kind of active there, and then there was this spike right here. That spike was probably associated with this drop-off here. But overall, it was fairly quiet, although you notice at the end of the day there was some more activity in the stock right here at the end of the day. But overall, it was pretty much a consistent trading day. Let me go to something else. Anyone got a stock you want to ask, you're interested in? Anything? I think. What is it? OXLT. OXLT. LC. OXLC. Let me back that up here. OXLC. OXLC. Oxford Lane. Yeah, it went up 1% today. It declared, what did you say? It declared a dividend, a special dividend? Look at that stupid dividend yield. That's a dividend. Well, you're right. I mean, that's not a spectacular dividend dollar-wise. It's $1.62 a share. And I can get a lot of stocks with a higher one. But as a percent of the price of the stock, that is an 18% yield on the price. Notice how it didn't impress the markets, though, very much. The stock is losing money, which is really weird. Here's the thing. Remember that the stock, the dividends come out of earnings. You've paid your bills for the period, and then whatever's left belongs to the shareholders. You can put that back into the company, or you can pay it out as a dividend. Here's a company that's losing money. It's actually losing $2.10 per share, and yet they're handing out these insane dividends. So in other words, this company lost $2.10 a share, and it made it worse for itself by then giving each shareholder $1.62 for each share. So this is almost like, why are they doing this? This is crazy. You're already in a hole, so what you're going to do is dig deeper into the hole to make it worse for yourself. And of course, the market said, well, yeah, that's nice. For a while, we'll take those dividends, and then we'll say, see you when you go bankrupt. That's an odd, odd thing. It's almost like, and by the way, the price earnings ratio is essentially, you take the price divided by the company's earnings. In other words, this is how much the market is willing to pay. The investors are willing to pay for every dollar that they have claim to. Remember, the earnings are what the earnings per share is. How many dollars each stock share has claimed to. So the price to earnings is how much investors are willing to pay for each of those dollars. So in this case, you can't talk about a PE ratio with a company that's losing money. It's just not a measure you can do. But in general, we look at PE ratio as sort of a measure of how many dollars investors are willing to throw at a company. Let me show you a company that's healthy. Thank you for that one. That was interesting, though. LMT, Lockheed Martin. Oh, they're down, too, a little bit. Now this here's one. This price earnings ratio is 20. Now that is considered to be in this day and age, that's considered to be a fairly low PE ratio. In other words, for every dollar the company has earned that belongs to the shareholders, investors are willing to throw $20 at it. In a way, what that means is that investors think that every dollar the company has made that belongs to the shareholders, the company will turn into $20 for the shareholders over the life. Now, then that means that as that PE ratio goes up, investors are putting more faith in the company's ability to generate a lot of money per dollar. So this one's pretty quiet, though. Now notice here that this is Lockheed Martin, LMT. It's a New York Stock Exchange. Three letters, NYSE, or something like that. So there's that. Now, again, we had an erosion on it. Bid and ask are fair. Well, again, notice these are big numbers. So, you know, the bid-ask spread can be a little wider. But if you wanted to buy this, you'd buy it at $424.40. If you were selling some of the shares, you'd sell them at $423.75. That's the bid-ask spread. Now notice that this one, the volume was below its 52-week moving average. So it was a little quieter day for Lockheed Martin on the street. They pay a nice little dividend. This is a nice dividend, 2.25%. That's not bad. In other words, you aren't guaranteed dividends as a shareholder. However, companies that don't pay their dividend tend to get punished because investors expect that if you start paying dividends, you're going to keep paying them. So in a way, when you buy this, put $424.42 into the stock, you are like putting money into an account where you kind of are expecting to get at least a 2.25% return. You're going to get a dividend. Now, you'll also get money if the stock price goes up. That's called the capital gain. We'll cover that next week and the week after that. But for the time being, at least, this would be considered, the stock's beta is below 1. I'll talk more about that in the future. But beta measures risk. It's our preferred measure of risk. 1 is like the fulcrum. Below 1, fairly safe. Above 1, riskier. In this case, it's relatively safe. The beta is below 1. PE ratio is below 30. Those are safe. It pays a nice little dividend, 2.25%. This would be probably something that if you were more of a risk-averse investor, or perhaps an older investor who wants more of the assurance of a dividend than the risk of capital gain on a stock, this would be one of those kinds of stocks in a somewhat more defensive portfolio. Notice I'm throwing terminology at you. Defensive portfolio here, as opposed to what we might call an aggressive portfolio or a growth portfolio, to put it in a little bit more politically correct terminology. But there you go. So now you've seen a stock that was on the NASDAQ. You've seen a stock that was on the New York Stock Exchange. Those are each in markets, stock markets, and I'll go into that in a little more detail. But I'm going to cover a little ground, go back and redo some ground. But let me show you something real quick here. ETFs and mutual funds. I'll mention those tonight to show you something about them. An ETF is essentially a fund that buys a portfolio. Then you buy stock in that fund, and essentially you're buying a giant diversified portfolio. You can buy portfolios that track indexes like the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow. You can buy ETFs that track technology stocks, medical stocks. ETFs, there are so many out there. And the good thing about ETFs is that you don't have to buy lots of different stocks to build your own portfolio to have it well-balanced and well-diversified. It's done for you. You buy the ETF, you've got professional fund managers watching that portfolio to keep it balanced and all that every day. It's wide in its diversification, so you don't have diversifiable risk in it. It's a good way for investors to get a lot of punch. Here's one. SPY, the spider. This is tracking the Standard & Poor's 500. In other words, you don't have to buy 500 different stocks. You have one stock that is those 500 in one package. It's just like a regular stock. You put in your order, I want one round lot of SPDR at market, something like that. And then the order would go in and it would just show up in your portfolio like any other stock would, sitting there doing its own thing. Now, one thing notice here, notice the beta. It's exactly the market because essentially the Standard & Poor's 500 is so large, the companies are so vast that they comprise maybe 60 to 70% of the entire world market cap. So by buying the Standard & Poor's 500, you are riding the market exactly on a dime. And that's the ETF. Notice that this is not a cheap thing to get into. One share of this is going to cost you $331. A round lot, which is 100 shares, would cost you $33,134. Well, you know, basically. Now, expense ratio. With ETFs and mutual funds are another way to have instant diversification. The expense ratio is important to watch because some of these funds have high expense ratios. You run an ETF and you. You are the big dogs in this ETF. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. You pay yourselves insanely big salaries. You also have all kinds of meals and entertainment. You have all the greatest luxury offices right in downtown Manhattan. Your expense ratio is 2%. That means I'm not going to get involved with you. You're bleeding off so much of the money that fund is making that you're taking that away from me as the actual owner of the stock you're managing. So you want to look out for a high expense ratio. What's high? I walk away from anything that's got an expense ratio above 0.3 to 0.5%. This one has a very low expense ratio. It's a wonderful thing. Let me show you another ETF. This is a very different one, but it's actually also very similar. Each of these is called a benchmark. A benchmark is something that you would measure other portfolios against. You want to make your own portfolio? Wonderful. Let's measure it against what would have happened if you had stopped doing that and just indexed. In other words, buy a spider. Here's another one, AGG. It's a bond ETF. It invests in bonds. It's a benchmark for bond portfolios. Notice again, right on the money, it is tracking the bond market. It is perfect to the bond market. So in other words, it's got exactly the same risk as the world portfolio of bonds would. And again, notice this one has an even more attractive expense ratio. Either of these is a great expense ratio. But again, notice these are well managed. The efficiency is good. They pay themselves really well, but they don't pay themselves so much and spend so much money that they're taking a lot away from you, the owners of this. And this one's one. If you're into bonds, their safety and all of that, you could do this instead of buying a portfolio of 30, 50 different bond issues, and you've got all of what those bonds would do for you, all in one package, managed for you. That's why, in general, we recommend strongly that whether or not you want to go entirely with ETFs and mutual funds, it's an awful good idea to make them the big part of your portfolio. And the other things in your portfolio, individual stocks, are almost just like side plays in the main portfolio. In fact, my main portfolio is primarily mutual fund and then ETFs. There are no individual stocks in it. I don't want to bother with chasing down stocks and getting all kinds of excited when they go up and down. Should I buy or sell? they just behave the way I want. And they have betas that are the betas that I want. You can find a beta for any. You want a beta of 1.3 and you want technology stocks, there's an ETF or a mutual fund for you. You want to be a defensive investor, you want a beta of, let's say, 0.65, and you want to have all your stocks international, okay, there are ETFs and mutual funds. Just buy one of those and you've got everything you want. You don't have to kill yourself with a whole lot of research. Again, though, you can buy individual stocks and bonds as side bets in a portfolio. There's nothing wrong with that. It kind of unbalances your portfolio a little bit, but it gives you something to do on a quiet night when you're not staggering around outside of the pub, too. Trying to think here. Here's one that really irritates me, and I'll talk very briefly about this tonight. I have a derivative. I have an open put. I'm long a put on Walmart. And what does Walmart do? Right near the expiration of the put, it decided to go up in value. A put is a bet that a stock is going to drop in value. This thing was dropping, but by God, once they knew that I was investing in it, they decided to drive the price up. Okay, enough of that. A couple other things. Let me get this off here. I might go back to this in a little while. Well, I can't. My mind is drawing a blank. I showed you the NASDAQ. I showed you an NYSE. I wanted to show you an AMEX, and I'm just completely blank on an AMEX stock right now. I'm just completely blanking. But anyway, let me do something. Markets. Different ways to divide up markets, and this is a repeat of some of what I said the last time. Markets. Spot versus future. Spot markets are where you pay the price sitting there now. I buy at spot. Okay. Now, you, sir, you decide that you're hungry for some snackies. And so you decide that you're going to go out at 1 a.m. to Walmart and find some snackies. You will buy snackies at spot. Whatever the price is, that's what you're going to buy. You, sir, however, are one of those forward-looking people. You make an agreement with Walmart. I shall buy snackies 1 week from today, and I shall buy them at $2.50 a bag, regardless of what the price of the snackies are at spot. That's a futures market. Now, of course, Walmart would have to agree to this, and it would be an OTC transaction. In other words, it'd be a custom agreement, as opposed to one that's an exchange agreement. You can't buy futures contracts on snackies. You know, I wonder if I could make a market like that, if I could get people to go long and short futures on Doritos or Sun Chips or something like that. But anyway, okay, so spot markets are common for you. However, interestingly enough, futures markets are insanely large in the world out there. Most people have no idea just how ridiculously large the forward contracts, options, calls, futures, all kinds of exotica out there are. That essentially they are what stabilizes the world, because suppose that you are a coffee grower in South America. I am a coffee barista brewer house here in Bloomington. I know that I'm going to need 5,000 pounds of coffee in 6 months. Now I can just go into the spot market in 6 months and buy coffee beans at spot. Or I could make a custom OTC over-the-counter arrangement with you. I shall buy from you 5,000 pounds of coffee beans in 6 months at $5 per pound, regardless of the spot price at that time. regardless. Now here's what here now what this does. It does for me, I know what I'm going to spend in 6 months. This is, by the way, called a forward contract. I know what I'm going to spend in 6 months. I'm going to spend 5,000 times 5, $25,000. You know, as a grower, what you are going to receive in 6 months. For both of us, it just completely removes the price volatility risk. It removes one of the worst problems that both of us have, because that's unpredictability of cash flow. For me, this makes certain the cash outflow. It will be $25,000. For you, it makes certain the cash revenue you will get. So you can make your projections for expenditures and all that, because you know what you're going to get in 6 months. Now, suppose that in 6 months, let's say the spot in 6 months is $4.85 per pound. Well, I have agreed to buy at $5. So I'm kind of screwed on this, because I could have bought it at $4.85, but I've already agreed to $5. So it sounds like I kind of got the raw end of that deal. Now, you are happy, because if you'd sold at spot, you would have gotten only $4.85, but you're going to get $5 instead. You follow me on this? So it sounds like it's a bad deal for me. It's a great deal for him. Actually, it's not as bad for me as it sounds, because even though I'm paying more than I would have at spot, that's armchair quarterbacking. I have known for 6 months exactly what my expenditure would be. So I knew what my planning was going to be based upon that expenditure. So even though I'm paying a little more, 15 cents a pound more than I would have if I had waited, I've known for 6 months exactly what I would spend. I can stand here now and say, well, damn it, I could have gotten it for $4.85. You didn't know that 6 months ago. You had absolute uncertainty. But with that forward agreement, you knew for sure. Now, looking on the other side of it, suppose the spot in 6 months is $5.40 per pound. Well, now I am saying, oh, thank God, I'm going to buy it at $5, so I'm saving myself money. You, on the other hand, are kicking yourself. Ah, I should have waited. I could have gotten a spot at $5.40. Now I'm going to sell it to this son of a bitch at $5. Yeah, you're hurt, but at the same time, not as much as one might think. Because for 6 months, you have known exactly what you were going to get. You've removed the risk. You can plan, I will have $25,000 in 6 months. That means that you can figure out how much you can spend in 6 months, 6 months before. You follow? So it's not as bad, even for what looks like the loser, in a forward agreement. We have removed risk. And companies hate risks like this. We are not in the business of price volatility. We're in a business that's something else entirely. With farmers, for example, we will set up what are called hedges. And this is another term that comes tonight. We will create a hedge so that it's essentially a farmer is long an asset. Corn, let's say. That farmer creates corn and sells it. However, some years corn is way up in price, the farmer has a great year. Some years, though, that corn is down there in the dirt and the farmer can barely feed his family or her family. We can fix that. We can take what's called a hedge, an opposite position in a futures market for corn. In that futures market, what we do is we sell a futures contract on corn for the farmer. Now, if corn goes up in price, this futures contract burns the farmer. But if corn goes down in price, that farmer makes a great amount of money on that futures contract. So in other words, they actually create a complete, not complete, we can't do perfect hedges, but they create a very effective way to smooth out the cash flow. When corn prices are up, the farmer wins on the corn, loses on the future. But when corn prices are down, the farmer loses on the corn but wins on the future. So in any given year, the farmer's actual income is pretty much stable. And that means that the farmer can focus on his core business, that is growing corn, and not worry about prices of corn and all of the world dynamics that affect the prices of crops and grains and all that. We have fixed that. We have removed a risk that that farmer would otherwise face, income volatility. We removed that through these derivatives, as we call them. Futures, forward agreements, options, those are called derivatives. They're a market. They're an enormous, vast market. Some of it is highly regulated, highly standardized. A lot of it is custom stuff. You keep hearing me say OTC. That's over-the-counter. That essentially means it's some kind of a custom agreement. I'll talk a lot more about those during this course. If you get interested, major in finance, and do something very crazy, take my derivatives course. It's one of the terminal courses in an undergraduate major. Most people don't take it. I don't know why. It's not that hard. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No. Okay. Moving on. Okay, different kinds of markets. We got spot versus futures. Another one we would want to talk about, really important, is primary market versus secondary market. Madam, you own a company. You decide that you want to go public. In other words, you want to sell ownership to other people. And you want to do it in a way that those people can sell their shares of stock, which represent ownership, or buy more stock, whatever they want. You'll have to jump through a whole lot of hoops with the Securities and Exchange Commission. You'll have to jump through hoops in the states in which you want to offer and sell your stock. But when someone buys that stock, that is a primary market transaction because you are going to get that money. You sell your stock for $25 a share. Really? $25 a share for that company of yours? I don't think. Oh, okay, fine. I'll buy a round lot. Okay, that $25 a share, I buy a round lot of that. That's going to be $2,500. You get that $2,500. Minus commissions if it's done through an investment bank. Okay? Great. Now, I've got that stock, and I'm really disappointed in you. I mean, I thought this company was going to do great, but I don't think so, no. So I sell it to some sucker, you. Now, that is a secondary market transaction because you have nothing to do with this whatsoever. You're out of this. You buy it from me for, let's say, I sell it to you for $30,000, the round lot, okay? That's between us. That has nothing whatsoever to do with the company anymore. A secondary market transaction. So, here's the thing. Three ways that a company could go public. The way that most people see it happen, although they don't really understand that it's happening this way, is through an investment bank. Investment banks are institutions, financial institutions. The investment bank will get together other investment banks, and you want to sell, let's say you want to sell 1 million shares, okay? What we will do is buy those from you. We will give you a firm underwriting. You don't have to sell it to anyone. We're buying it. We price it. We do the marketing of it. All of that, we just buy it from you. And then we sell it from our account. Usually we'll sell it to our rich investors, pump the price up, and then once we pump the price up, we'll dump it out onto suckers out there like you and me. So you say, well, I invested in Facebook's IPO, initial public offering. No, you didn't. You most certainly did not. You were not within 1,000 miles of the primary transaction. The primary transaction was between you and the investment banking syndicate. After that, we will spit that out into the market, and that will be all secondary market transactions. Companies that do go through this. Let me show you one right here. Come on. Do I need a hand crank on this computer? Here's one. One of the competitors of Uber was Lyft. Is Lyft. Now, Lyft, let's go to its 1 year. Well, actually, was that more than a year ago that happened? It was just a little more than, okay, we'll do the 5 year. Oh, it's not telling me what I want to know. Okay, the thing though was, oh, that's right, because what's the date? March of 19, okay. We pumped that sucker up there into the stratosphere to sell it to suckers. And then once we dumped it, boom, 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 drops down through the floor. The investment banking syndicate took care of the initial. We sold it. The investment banking syndicate bought it from Lyft at something, I don't know, it was like $60, $70 a share. Then we made sure that we got it to our wealthy families and other clients and big players, and we pumped it up, we hyped it. And then once we'd gotten it up there to a nice fat price, it eventually got to something like 82, 84, then we started calling people like you, madam. Ring, ring. Hi, I'm your broker. I care about you. I have got a stock. It is already blown out on the IPO, clear up to $84 a share. I think this is a buy for you right now. Because I'm telling you this, and I'm not going to tell anyone else. You've seen what it's done already. It's going to go higher. Okay. So what do you say? 1,000 shares? 10 round lots? Yeah. Okay. Got it in for you. Okay, thanks. Bye. Okay. And as we sell it off, the selling pressure drops the price down. We've made ourselves a fortune by charging you all of our underwriting fees. And then we've made our real clients, our important clients, our rich clients, very happy because the price appreciation made their portfolios bigger. And then, of course, you really don't matter. I mean, we do care, but not about you. Does that sound bad? Welcome to the capitalist world. Oh, they don't do that. Oh, they most certainly do. For God's sake, I was in that world. Okay, so anyway. So you will do secondary market transactions. That's what you're going to get into. Unless it's not a firm underwriting. What I talked about was where an investment banking syndicate buys the IPO. That's firm underwriting. Now, there are other kinds. There is, for example, a best efforts. We sometimes call this a Western style because the East Coast boys do those firm commitments. The Western towns, they do it differently. Okay, you want to do an IPO for 1 million shares? We're not going to buy it from you, but what we will do is we will do our best to sell it on your behalf. We might even buy a little bit of it ourselves. And if it shows like it's going to go somewhere, well, we might even buy up what's out there, okay? So that's a best efforts kind of underwriting where we don't do it. Now, in my business, we would do for small companies, sometimes my groups would do best efforts. You're going to raise $1 million, and you're going to do it with $10 a share for 100,000 shares. Okay, we're not going to buy this from you. However, we will help you sell it. And if If it works, it works. If it doesn't, don't bitch at us. We did what we could. It was a Western-style offering. And then the last kind is dangerous as all hell, a self-underwriting, where the company itself, its people, sell the stock. And I say it's risky as hell because I saw it happen. Companies, we tried to explain to them all of the laws, the rules for legal offer and legal sale, all of that kind of stuff. And I'll be a son of a dog if the companies didn't slip or make a mistake. Oftentimes it was an honest mistake, and the SEC would and the states would come in there and just put a fist down on them, send the people to prison, destroy the companies. Sometimes suspiciously, those technologies those companies had would disappear, and then a few years to 10, 20 years later, they'd pop back up again with some big company that had invented something incredible that we saw in one of these companies that got destroyed by the SEC 10, 20 years later. One of them that I can tell you right now about was back in the 1990s. A small company had developed the technology so that when someone wrote a signature on this electronic pad, it created exactly a legal signature. And they screwed up trying to sell the offering. They were so desperate to get the money because they were basically days from going out of business. And they got caught by some very ambitious little rats in the Division of Securities of the state of Ohio. Yeah, the statute of limitations is out, so kiss my ass. The dirty rats that did it to them just tricked them into admitting that they were using some of the money to pay themselves salaries. And that's a no-no. And so the company was shut down. Three guys went to prison, and the technology vanished until, well, spank me Jesus, that thing starts showing up in the 2000s. And now it's all over the place. Sign here with your finger. You know, I can't do that. I don't know why. So self-underwritings are risky as all hell. Because the states are going to say, you made a mistake. The feds are going to say, you made a mistake. One classic example was a beer company. It was using an exemption where a company can sell a certain amount of stock without registering it with the SEC. Now, it will be a private placement. The stock will be restricted. But they can raise up to a certain amount of money without going through all of the insane, expensive, legal mumbo-jumbo and paperwork. Well, this company had this innovative idea. This beer got really popular. This has been years ago. I mean, it was sort of like one of the early craft beers in a way, but it had a national following. This company was having orders for its six-pack bottle packs of beer far beyond its ability to produce. So it needed to raise money and get this operation expanded ASAP. Their idea was to put the selling document, which is called a prospectus, but when it's a private placement like this, it's called an offering circular. They put an offering circular in every six-bottle pack of their beer so that Joe Potbelly would be drinking beer. Burp, oh, look at that. Well, I could buy stock in this company. Well, spank me. I'm going to buy some. It worked magnificently. It was insane. The problem was that they got more subscriptions for the stock than was legally allowed under this exemption from securities law. They were allowed to raise only a certain number of millions of dollars, and they didn't know they were getting in $10, $12, $15 million. And they thought, oh my God, it oversubscribed. They kept the money. And the SEC stepped in and said, bad boys, you have to give back every penny that you raised. You're going to pay a fine that will knock you dead, and you are not allowed to do it again for 2 years. The company nearly went bankrupt, but the company is still in business. It recovered from it with the help of some very private investors who understood, yeah, they screwed up, but still the core business is incredible. And so the company survived it, but self-underwriting. Don't do it. This company was relatively decent size. Its people weren't stupid, but they weren't securities experts. They were beer makers, for God's sake. Okay, now, primary versus secondary. Getting back to it. A primary market transaction, the company gets the money. A secondary market transaction, it's simply a deal between a buyer and a seller. Let me show you something real quick here. Here's a problem with investment banking, or it's a problem even no matter how you're going to sell stock. What price do you charge for your stock? Okay, I want to raise, let's say, $10 million. Okay, do I sell 1 million shares at $10 a share? Is the market going to accept that? What's the price that the market is going to bear for this offering? Here's how it is often done. Most people think about auction. They think about what is called an English auction. I used to be, and I still do it for charity events, I was a professional auctioneer. Now, the way you think of auctions, okay, you sir, I am an auctioneer and we are auctioning you off at a Sotheby's auction. Here we have a classic example of a North American male. He is strapping. He will work for at least 5 years. He will provide services including cooking, gardening, and indeed walking the dog. Do I have a bid of $50? And then we go through what an auctioneer would do. Anyone anywhere want to buy this man at 50? I need a bid 50. I need a bid. Anyone anywhere want to buy a bid 50? And someone raises 50. I need 55. Anyone anywhere? I need a bid of 55. You got a bid of 55. You got a bid of 55. Now we're going to 60. 60. 60. Do I have 60? It ratchets up until no one bids higher. That's an English auction. Price goes up. The other way it's done is called a Dutch auction, where the price goes down. Okay, let me show you. I need to find the price for a stock. And I need to sell, let's say, 5,000 shares. That's what I need to sell. So, let's say that I try a price of $25. I will get 1,000 subscribers. At a price of 20, I solicit my subscriber, and I find that I can get 2,000 subscribers at $20. At $25, I can get 4,000 subscribers. At $30, I can get 7,000 subscribers. Okay, you follow me there? The price will be $30. That's a Dutch auction. You see, because what I do is I find the best price at which I can clear the subscription. Now, it might actually be a little bit different from this. I might, let's change these numbers. 1,000, 1,500, 25, let's do 2,000, 2,000, and at $25, I get, let's say, 3,000. Okay. Now, and then at $20, I get 2,000. No, let's say 1,500. It gets so cheap that people don't want to buy it. So in this case, what I would do is I would set the price at $20 a share, because then the people who were going to pay 30 will jump in at 25. The people at 30, I'm sorry, will jump in, and so I will subscribe it out piecemeal in a Dutch that way. See, all you need to do is get the price low enough that enough people there and above it will buy in at that price. That's a Dutch auction. That's essentially how the Wall Street boys do it. They'll call all of the, they'll check in with all of their big dog investors, and they'll say, all right, are you going to buy this at, let's say, $85 a share? I can get together maybe 100,000 people, but we need at least 300,000. Okay, let's see what they'd say if we went to $80 a share. We can get some more there, and you just keep bringing down the price until you get enough at that price and above. That becomes the price at which you open the you do the offering. Again, that's called a Dutch auction. There's one other kind of auction called a sealed bid auction, or a silent bid sometimes it's called, where no one knows what anyone else is bidding until you open and you take, you take the highest bid, or if you're basically hiring someone, you take the lowest bid among those that are sealed. Anyway, those are that's just a, not really a side thing, but it's important for you to know that's how this kind of a market works. You folks will be in essentially a Dutch auction when you come out to go get a job. You sir, what's your major? Never mind. Okay. What's your major?
Accounting.
Really?
Marketing.
Marketing. Good, good, good. Okay, now, here's the thing. Now, what's your major?
Marketing.
Who's got insurance? You'll make a lot of money. What are you marketing? Okay, good. Insurance is great. Just don't get into personal lines. Stay in commercial lines. Okay. Now, you, sir, go out there, and I am hiring someone for marketing. And I say, what is your expectation for salary? You say, well, I'd like $70,000 a year. Now, I come to you. You've applied for the job, too. What is your expectation? You don't know about him, but you say $50,000 a year. Oh, it's marketing. Okay, $30,000. The $50,000 a year, if you do the quantitative analytics or the integrated thing, that's when the salary goes way up. Trust me on that. Okay. You see, it's a Dutch auction. I'm going to hire you. That will be the prevailing. And then anyone else who comes in, I will now know 30 is the low bid in the Dutch. So if you're in marketing, I'm going to look for you. And the best I'll do for you is 30. I'm not going to do any more. If I can. The problem, though, is that if I get desperate and I can't find someone else at 30, then I might be able to get you at 35. That's a problem for me, though, because then if you hear about it, you're going to just pitch a fit, right? So that's why we have these non-disclosure. You're not supposed to talk with your fellow employees about your salary. It's a privacy issue. No, it's not. They're trying to keep you from finding out he was paid more than you, and you go into the executive boardroom and you say, you sexist bitches. Anyway, enough of that. But again, this is actually real life stuff. I mean, we don't think of these terms, and the common person would have no idea what you mean by a Dutch auction. But interestingly enough, eBay is a combination of an English and a Dutch auction. Each round is an English auction because you're bidding the price upward against each other. And that just pisses me off because, you know, I'm right there, 5 seconds left, I got that product, and some old bag in Poughkeepsie takes it away from me by dumping 2 pennies on me. God, that irritates. Oh, anyway. Okay. However, the other side of it is a Dutch auction. Suppose no one bids at your minimum reserve price. Then the auction expires, and when you come back, you're going to offer a lower price because you know that the original price that you offered at didn't work. So if you want to sell it, you start the auction again with setting your reserve price lower. I did that about a year ago with a camera. I set the price opening at $600. Not one person bid. So what did I do? As soon as it was over, I waited I did a cooling off period, and then I came back at $500, and then it worked. Do you see how that's a Dutch auction? Essentially, it's a Dutch auction and an English auction system all in one. Now, next thing, markets. I should look on here. I've brought these kinds of markets up before. Financial markets versus commodity markets. Financial versus commodity. In commodity markets, that is things. Corn, wheat, gold, hog bellies. Anything you could imagine probably has some kind of a market for it. Obviously, it wouldn't exist if there weren't a market for it. Now, some of these markets are legal markets. Some of them are gray markets. Some of them are patently illegal markets. But they are for physical things that are traded in some kind of a manner that has its own organization. If there are buyers for something, there will be sellers of it. The opposite of that, which used to be thought true in conservative economics, it was called Say's Law, supply creates its own demand. Well, probably not, that's not true. But if there is a need, there will be something that provides for that need. Legal or illegal. And I'm sure you've never touched an illegal market before in your lives. Not one of you, not even you potheads. But the bottom line is also, though, interestingly enough, some markets that at one time were legal become illegal for commodities, and sometimes illegal markets become legal markets. At one time, opium was legal. When I was a kid, when you got violently sick to keep you from dying from dehydration, they'd pour you full of this opium solution called paregoric. I mean, that to eating that, you will be sworn off heroin for the rest of your life. Although it did make me feel really good afterwards. But it was legal. Now, that's illegal. On the other hand, pot used to be illegal. It is becoming legalized now because the states have finally figured out, oh, we can make money off these people when they get baked. And some are gray. It's legal, but not when everyone's using it. Adderall. You go and visit with Addy or technically Molly is legal if in some psychiatric wards, but not at a party. Anyway, financial markets. Those things don't exist in the physical world. Financial markets include markets for interest rates. Stock is a financial market. Stock is not a physical thing. Well, I got me a certificate. Well, actually, you don't anymore. They're all electronic, probably. But even when there was a certificate, there was no such physical thing as stock, because stock is nothing but ownership, and ownership is not a physical entity. Other financial markets, currency markets, vast, wide, extraordinary in their size and the activity, madness in the currency markets. Other financial instruments, all kinds of exotic things, derivative kinds of things, and there's another one too. It sits in its own world almost. It's a market in and of itself. It can be a financial or a commodity. These are called derivatives. A derivative is a financial instrument whose value is based on an underlying asset. A derivative is a financial instrument whose value is based upon an underlying asset. Now, derivatives come in all flavors. If it is a custom, like that thing that you and I did with the coffee, that's a derivative, because the value of that contract itself is based upon the value of an underlying asset called coffee beans. Okay? If I wanted to sell my position in that contract to someone else who was a coffee brewer, well, I would be essentially selling a derivative contract, and there would be a value for that contract, price. That would be, however, OTC action. In other words, whatever happens in the over-the-counter derivatives market, it is entirely what the parties agree to on the fly for that particular occasion. However, there are organized derivative markets. Futures markets, many options contracts, those are organized. The contracts are standardized. There's a clearinghouse, so that if there were a contract out there for coffee beans that was traded in a futures market, you and I wouldn't talk. We would simply enter that market for our positions. I would never know you, never see you. You would not care about my credit risk. I wouldn't care about your risk, because the clearinghouse guarantees the contract will happen. Those are exchanges. The futures markets are clearinghouses, standardized contracts. Options that you buy on stocks, like I bought a put option on Walmart. That was entirely, I didn't negotiate with Walmart. I didn't negotiate with a writer, the seller of that put. I just bought it. And I know that if it comes through and I win, I will be paid, not by whoever wrote that contract, whoever took the other side. The clearinghouse will take it out of that writer's pocket and put it into mine. That's an organized exchange. So in other words, what I'm talking about here is something that spans stock purchases. You don't buy stock from a company. You don't even buy stock. You wouldn't even buy that stock from me. You go through a broker-dealer, if it's an listed, it would go through a clearinghouse at the NASD, at NASDAQ. It would go through a clearinghouse. I would get the money. They would take the money out of your account, or you wouldn't be able to buy it if you didn't have the money or you didn't have a margin account. So we don't have to worry about each other's honesty, trustworthiness, looks. You're better looking than I am. Why would you sell to me? But you don't know what I look like. For all you know, I'm Brad Pitt. I really am. I just incognito. I do this on the side. You know, just, I don't want Jen to know I do this. Anyway, so you see, so in other words, we have this other thing, the OTC versus the exchange. And this applies to derivatives, it applies to stock, it applies to bonds. Unless you're involved in a private placement, there it's an OTC. Suppose that you would just want to privately place some stock. You need to raise some money, but I know that I have to meet certain restrictions. I have to be a sophisticated investor and all of that, so that you don't have to register the stock and all that great stuff. Okay, well, that's fine. We can do that as long as we meet the rules. That would be an OTC, because there's no exchange involved. You're simply going to sell me stock, give me some kind of a statement that I own this stock and this percentage of ownership in the company, other agreements that I would insist on in the agreement, and all of that. But there's no exchange involved. You have to know that I am going to pay you for it. I have to know that you're worth investing in. So in other words, in a market like this, one, it's more expensive because you have to, OTC market, you have to do your due diligence. When you do it on an exchange, I don't give a rat's ass about who I'm buying and selling from, because it all goes through a third party. It's all arm's length. But if it's OTC, I am all at risk and so are you. We need to make sure each other is safe, reliable, and all that good stuff, and that we can come to a meeting of minds based upon level, timing, and risk. in a financial intermediation environment. Now, USER might broker the deal between us, but nevertheless, you're not an exchange. We would still, you would take on the risk of it, because if you screwed her over, she'd sue you. You screw me over, I'd sue you. So there's still that risk involved there. And also the other part of it is liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another. Now, I caution you that I will find a way to ask this on a quiz and or an exam. You go to the internet, and you will find that their definitions look almost exactly like mine, but they are not. There are a couple of words, one word or several words, that are different. They are wrong. It's the internet. When you get information off the internet, it's probably coming from an imbecile, a crazy person, or a cat. Don't you wonder why there's so many cat pictures? It's cats who are running the internet, for God's sake. My cats do it. I catch them doing it. What are you doing? Nothing. Of a cat? It's a furry animal who doesn't care. Liquidity is the efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another. Now, one of the things is liquidity is how is the ease with which what an asset can be exchanged for cash. That's a really stupid definition, because you've included an asset, cash, in the definition. Cash has high liquidity because you can exchange that for another asset. A bar of gold actually doesn't have very good liquidity. A share of stock doesn't have really great liquidity, at least in some ways. A house has a great deal of value, but it is a highly illiquid asset. I drive through the drive-thru at McDonald's, okay? Beep. May I McHelp you? Why, McYes. I would like a cheeseburger, McPlease. That will be $4 and $0.65. Well, McThank you, please McPull around to the first McWindow. Okay, I pull around to that McWindow, and now I've got $4.65. I get my cheeseburger. I pull out my house. Here's your damn. I'm not going to get my cheeseburger. The efficiency with which one asset can be exchanged for another is low for that. Okay? So in other words, liquidity is part of talking about OTC versus exchange. In an exchange, literally these days, I mean, back when I was doing stock, I was running a penny stock house. I mean, it could take literally weeks to get a stock transaction executed, especially with a small peant house like I had. But now, I mean, it's just like instant lightning. I put in this stupid order for a stock about a week ago. I put in the order, and literally before I pulled the mouse down so I could get it out of the way, it said executed. Wait, what? I mean, it was just like there was no time delay. It went 100 shares long before I could even move the mouse out of the way. Now, that's liquidity. However, that's an exchange. That was an exchange. It was traded. The stock was traded on the NASDAQ. Wonderful. But I mean, if it's OTC, good grief. Getting the whole, first of all, getting the contract put together for the exchange, that's going to take some time. You're going to have to probably get some lawyers involved. Insurance may be involved. All those kinds of things. Investigation has to be involved of the parties each to the other. And then, if you want to try to sell your side of a contract, of an OTC contract, good luck with that. You probably won't find someone. Well, I shouldn't say that. They're kind of like these middle people who they'll hear, okay, you've got a forward contract. You want to unload it. Let me see what I've got. People who are looking for contracts like that. So yeah, it's there, but it's still highly illiquid. OTCs are not all that great in general. Some are pretty liquid, but a lot of that OTC action, once I have bought that stock from you, I mean, I might have first of all, it would be illegal for me to just sell it to someone because it's restricted stock, because it didn't go through the legal hoops. The second thing is, I mean, even if I followed the rules and unloaded the stock, geez, zooey. I mean, it could be weeks, months before I found someone, someone like that. That's why one of the things I hear this pop fad with, oh, I'm forming an LLC. Okay, you're forming an LLC. Do you realize that once you become an owner in an LLC, they're called members, you are in the program. You ain't going to be able to ever get rid of that membership except through the closing of the LLC. You, first of all, it would probably be illegal as hell for you to do it, but if you wanted to try to figure out some trick to get out from under it, good luck with finding someone who's going to want to do some custom thing like an LLC. Every LLC is an OTC. It's a custom deal. Every membership agreement is a weird custom deal. Membership, LLCs have a cool thing that corporations don't have. In a corporation, every owner, the shareholders, is the same status. You have equal claims to the cash flows of the corporation, the residual. In an LLC, you can set up different classes of members. Some members will get most of the ongoing cash flow that's left over, the residual. And then other members will get what's valued at the end of the LLC's life. You can't do that very easily with a corporation. So yeah, that's an advantage of LLCs. The big downside, once you're an owner, you are in the program. There's no backing out. I've had this happen many, many times in my life. I can't stand it. I want to eat spicy foods even though they destroy my liver, my pancreas, and everything south down to my Achilles tendons. But there was this one time when I went to a place at the Mall of America called Calito Chili Traders. And I said, they'll give you a sample of whatever you want, anything. And so I said, give me the hottest thing you have. And she came back out wearing asbestos gloves and a tiny little bottle and a tortilla chip. And I noticed that the bottle said, death by stupidity. And she took it out, and she just tapped that little brush onto the tortilla chip, and she gave it to me. A crowd was gathering around me, and I put that in my mouth. I do not remember anything until I was in this bathroom down the hall. And I was at the sink wondering why I didn't go to the toilet for some swirly action. I looked at my face in the mirror, and I saw my skeleton. Now, I lived through it. 4 hours later, I was walking around, and I kept thinking to myself, I feel something odd. But I kept telling myself, I didn't swallow that tortilla chip. I'm sure I wouldn't have been that stupid. Well, the title of the on the bottle told me that was not the case. Once I'd swollen it, I was going to be in the program for the rest of the haul. This is the same thing with a membership in an LLC. You are there, once you have said yes, you are there until the magma finishes. Keep that in mind. I'm going to let you go. Thank you.